This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So the War Memorial in Vitebsk, the State Memorial Complex in Khatyn, and the memorial to the Jews of Bezhenkovichi who were killed in 1942 are just three elements of memorial culture in the Republic of Belarus, the formerly Soviet Republic that, alongside Ukraine, essentially bore the brunt of the German occupation of Soviet territories. Military losses, the civilian death as a result of unprecedented terror, and the murder of up to 80% of the Jewish pre-war population had a lasting impact on the society. Till today, the memory of this destruction plays an important role for public discourses, but it's also highly contested. We've already heard a little bit about that earlier. Today, I would like to outline some of these contestations and also use them to propose a new perspective on what it means to witness a genocide, the destruction of Soviet Jewry in the region. The title of this conference, of course, gestures toward a central question of Holocaust scholarship. What does it mean to witness the Holocaust? Survivors and scholars, philosophers, historians, literary scholars, artists discuss whether it's possible to describe the core, the true meaning of a genocide that was so violent, so systematic, so carefully planned and implemented that it completely shattered agreed-upon human norms. Genocide in this debate is defined as an event that denies its factuality by eliminating possible witnesses who experienced the full force of persecution, deprivation, dehumanization, and industrialized killing, is unable to bear witness. There are, the analysis goes, no complete witnesses who could possibly testify to the historical truth of the event, the Holocaust, which is mostly discussed as the industrialized murder in the death factories of Auschwitz and other camps of the Operation Reinhard. It is unspeakable, because its victims are psychologically incapacitated. Dori Laub and Kathy Karras have talked about that, and it exceeds the language that is available to us because of the extreme form of desubjectification that the witnesses underwent. To witness the inhuman would dehumanize the speaker, that's Giorgio Agamben's analysis. Or it is unwitnessable because the collective nature of the genocide makes personal accounts incongruous, that's Beryl Lang. In response, some of these scholars, and in addition, Shoshana Fellman, Ulrich Baer, or Jeff Hatley, and many others suggest that witnessing by proxy, meaning secondary witnessing, by artists, listeners of testimonies, is the only possible and also necessary way to recognize the genocide. In contrast, scholar Mark Nihanyan, very recently in Probing the Ethics of Holocaust Culture, maybe some of you have already looked at that book, recently argued that this form of witnessing actually diverts us from the event, from the core of the genocide, because narrativizing the event betrays the recognition that the genocide has compromised language and cannot be represented. In his logic, the unspeakable violence is written back into history. Witnessing, in essence, denies survivors the status of survivors because it denies that they survived an abnormal event. The problem is clear, but there are competing answers. I side with those who argue that we need to find a way to speak about the unspeakable, primarily because if we do not do so, we cannot speak about human responsibility for the killing of fellow humans. In Ruth Kluger's words, the Holocaust, quote, can be described just fine and in all detail, and survivors do exactly that. To claim that it is indescribable is a form of sentimental self-adulation that claims to be a sign of empathy. In fact, though, it's a way to evade facing the reality and the responsibility for atrocities committed by human beings. Alongside the clear description of what happened and how and by whom, we must state that genocidal destruction is an assault on humanity. It is an assault on individual lives and on communities. Because it destroys not only individual lives, but all generations of a given group, it is an assault on memory. Making mourning impossible, death and the lives lost have no meaning. Questions of what is to be witnessed, by whom, and to what trouble our thinking about the Holocaust in Eastern Europe, and we've heard multiple examples today. And very specifically, they trouble our thinking about the German-occupied Soviet territories. For one, the murder of Soviet Jewry, or Jews who resided in or were brought to the Soviet territories, was embedded in an assault on the whole population. For the most part, it took place not in death factories far away from the hometowns of its victims, as in the case of Western or Central European Jews, but in their hometowns or close by, and primarily in the form of mass shootings committed by the so-called Einsatzgruppen. Secondly, the role of local residents for the implementation of the genocide and for its forgetting pose a challenge when we try to understand the genocide of Jews in this region. Thirdly, local residents were often deeply traumatized themselves by the brutal air raids of the early weeks of the war, by starvation and occupation terror, by the anti-partisan warfare that destroyed their livelihoods and killed thousands of people. In a context where every fourth or even every third of the pre-war population died, that would be between 2.5 and 3 million people, the murder of 550,000 Jews, or what we now call the Holocaust, may not seem so different from the experience of the non-Jewish population. Outside of the Soviet Union, the mass killing of Soviet Jews was for a long time not an integral part of Holocaust scholarship. Now that it is for about two decades, it is often externalized as the Holocaust by bullets. It is not seen as the same Holocaust, but as something different. In keeping with the focus of the scholarship I mentioned earlier, the question is, what is the core of the Holocaust in the Soviet Union? Could an answer to the question, who is a possible witness for the Holocaust in the Soviet territories, offer a clue? The Musulman, or those who died in the gas chambers, or those who survived the extermination camps, have no equivalent in the killing fields. The process of destruction, as described by Hannah Arendt, consisting of the elimination of legal and moral personhood in preparation of the physical destruction, collapsed into a brief moment of roundup, ghettoization, and execution. The core of the genocide here has to be defined in a different way, and thus those who would bear witness to it as well. In the case of the Soviet territories, particularly in Belarus, another question presents itself. How does this assault differ from the killing of other people? I do not have complete answers to these questions, but I want to use them and the differences between the genocide committed in Auschwitz and the genocide committed in the towns and villages of Belarus. And essentially, it happened in at least 190 ghettos and nearby, to discuss a few elements and challenges of witnessing and remembering the Holocaust in the East, specifically in Belarus. Very commonly, the Soviet failure to commemorate the Holocaust in the German-occupied Soviet territories is thought to be the result of state-sponsored anti-Semitism and politics of memory that devalued civilian lives, especially those of non-Slavic nationalities, and foregrounded military and party achievements. I want to suggest that alongside these factors, we must consider the dynamics of the war and genocide themselves. That includes the assault on the whole population, the occupation terror against the civilian population as a whole, and the local participation of Soviet citizens. Last but not least, the nearly complete destruction of Jewish communities and heritage eliminated the potential for memory in ways that we begin to recognize only now. To elaborate these moments, I will draw on my recent research on the geographies of war, genocide, and memory in Vitebskaya Oblast. That will be this area around here. although I have to say that before and during the war, the borders of the oblast were slightly different. They changed after the war, but this is kind of what we would look at currently in terms of Vitebsk. And I turn to the practices of memory to illustrate the divisions that signal an externalization of the Holocaust and consequently the Jewish past in what used to be the Jewish Pale of Settlement of Imperial Russia. This investigation will focus on the area in and around Beshinkovichi, a small town on the western Dvina, but I also refer to other areas of the oblast. German troops crossed the border between Poland and the Soviet Union on June the 22nd, 1941, and quickly advanced through the Belarusian Soviet Socialist Republic. Within days, they reached Vitebskaya Oblast and established the rule of the Rear Area Army Group Center. The defending Soviet troops suffered terrible losses during the attempt to keep German troops out of Vitebsk. Locals experienced the advance as a surprise attack that within days destroyed their homes, displaced thousands, and shattered a world that was in the making. The Soviet Union was still a young state, and many, especially the young, believed in the promise for a better future. air raids and the speedy advance of German troops literally drowned these promises in fire. Many lost their family in the first days of the war, and thousands were displaced. Over the course of the following 3 years, Vitebská Oblast was one of the centers of the Soviet partisan movement. Partisan groups consisted of guerrilla fighters who gathered in the forest and swamps and took it upon themselves to attack German troops and their collaborators in the rear. Many of these partisans were Soviet soldiers who had lost contact to the units during the chaos of the first war months. Others were parachuted in from the Soviet rear to help build a force in the back of the German front. And in addition, more and more civilians joined the partisans, especially by 1943, after Stalin encouraged the partisan movement to admit anybody who had made it out of the occupied towns and cities. Till today, the numbers are not settled, but the consensus is that there were well over 380,000 active partisans in Belarus, and some of you might have heard the term partisan republic as a self-description of Belarus that is still used today. Eventually, Soviet troops, in coordination with this partisan movement, drove the German military out of the area in the summer of 1944. The heroism of military fighters, partisans, and their aides, which sometimes includes civilians who produce military equipment, is prominently displayed and commemorated in the Vitebsk Memorial Complex. Similar complexes can be seen in every larger formerly Soviet city, and I'm sure many of you have seen them. Smaller towns are more likely to commemorate and honor individuals or units that fought and often died in the region, and feature either anonymous obelisks with names inscribed, figures of combatants, abstract sculptures commemorating collectors, or if the gravesite is known, memorial plates. And we will return to that later by looking specifically at Bezhenkovichi. Many Soviet soldiers and many of the prisoners of war who died, however, did not receive a proper funeral and were, if at all, simply buried in their dugout. In 1994, the Belarusian government passed a law on the recovery and proper burial of soldiers' bodies, so many, many decades after the end of World War II. In some regions, search units are at work and actively search for human remains. Elsewhere, local volunteers fulfill that task, or locals simply stumble upon them. And for example, in Bezhenkovichi, over the last few years, many Soviet soldiers' remains have been found, to the point that local activists demanded that they finally commemorate the the casualties among the Soviet forces that had defended Bezhenkovichi. And in just last year, this monument was erected at a place called Strelka, which is on the other side of the Dvina. Civilian losses were similarly disregarded in the post-war Soviet Union, similarly to Soviet soldiers who had died, barely acknowledged in the first years after the war, and took until the late 1950s, that means after Stalin's death, for memorials addressing the loss of non-combatants to be erected. Since then, in Belarus, the suffering that the incredibly brutal German terror regime inflicted plays an important role in the public portrayal of the war. First of all, local residents were required to report to work for the occupation authorities, which included often continuing to work in their old positions as farmers or workers, but to surrender part of the yield, grain, vegetables, and fruit, but in many instances accept food rations instead of payment, which increased a level of starvation over the years. Civilian administrations established in areas that were secured by the German military regulated the use of the local labor force, natural and other resources, primarily with the goal to make the area productive so that it could sustain and support the ongoing war effort. And you can see here that Belarus was divided into multiple units. The major part was the General Commissariat of Weißruthenien, which was in really Belarusian territories. Part of what is now Belarus was part of the General Commissariat Volhynian-Podolian, and the other part was the General Commissariat of Zhytomyr. And that division was actually a strategy to crush any Belarusian self-administration during the war, but also to include them in an overall plan to restructure Eastern Europe. Some areas, however, like the eastern parts of Belarus, remained under military rule for the duration of the war. The situation there was never stable enough for the German military to establish the rule of civilians or to hand it over to a civilian administration, because regular fighting between Soviet and German troops, but also the increasingly strong and effective partisan movement sabotaged the German effort to bring the area under control. To appease the area, and this is true for both military and civilian-governed regions, German troops waged a very brutal anti-partisan warfare. The German leadership in this instance mobilized strong forces and considerable resources for the anti-partisan warfare. The Germans identified not only actual partisans, meaning combatants, as their enemy, but anyone who might potentially support the partisans. As practice would show, civilians of certain areas were subsumed under these groups, and Jews were considered enemies by definition, and those were primary targets for the anti-partisan warfare. After all, the logic went, they would certainly try to resist their own extermination if they could. Ideology and goals therefore justified themselves in perpetuity. And this logic of anti-partisan warfare directed against Jews determined the treatment of thousands of Jews who even managed to get out of the ghettos, who flee the ghettos and were trying to find a hiding place in the forest or were trying to hide or join the partisan movements and were killed en route, essentially to safer places. In addition, the German army, often supported by local police, SS, and so-called auxiliary forces that consisted of recruits from the region, planned and implemented several large-scale campaigns to crush the partisan movement and their supporters. During these campaigns, thousands of combatants, aides, or alleged supporters were killed, civilians deported for forced labor in Germany or labor camps, and cattle and grain were confiscated to feed German soldiers and civilians. Several of these hunts took place in Vitebskaya Oblast, as it was the site of a very active section of the partisan movement. One of the most brutal operations was the campaign Winterzauber, or Winter Magic, in February, March, and early April 1943. The goal of this campaign was the creation of a 30 to 40 kilometer wide dead zone along the border of what would now be Belarus and Latvia. All villages were to be destroyed, residents either killed or deported. And in the end, for example, the Osvieski Rayon, which was captured by this campaign, was completely razed. It didn't exist anymore. There was no village left. During the campaign overall, 439 villages or settlements were destroyed. At least 70,000 partisans died, but also over 13,000 residents were murdered for being partisan helpers. Over 7,000 residents were rounded up and deported to forced labor, and several hundred children were separated from their parents. Many of them were sent to the Salaspils concentration camp, where they were used as blood donors for the German military. And as you can imagine, many of the starving, exhausted, and abused children died as a result. An unknown number of children were placed in Latvian families. Until today, survivors are actually searching for information about their families of origin. So it's a very long-lasting effect of these partisan campaigns that people are still struggling with today. Overall, as a result of these anti-partisan operations, but also during the occupation more generally, more than 260,000 people died in Vitebskaya Oblast alone. Among them were over 90,000 prisoners of war, and more than 23,000 civilians were deported to forced labor. So you can see that there's a very high number of the civilian population that either died as a result of the war or was removed from the area. Similar numbers are, of course, available for other oblasts, other parts of current Belarus. And just to give you another idea of the extent of the destruction, in addition to the population loss, as Christian Gerlach has established, by the end of the war, 1.2 million residential houses in the countryside were in ruins. 90% of urban houses and public houses, public buildings were uninhabitable, and only 23% of the pre-war living space was left for use in the large cities of Minsk, Gomel, and Mogilev. 3 million people were homeless or lived in makeshift dvelings dug into the soil, so-called zemlyankas. From an economic perspective, the country's development was thrown back by decades. 85% of the industrial plants were damaged, and the economy's capacity had decreased by 95%. Crop space was nearly halved, and 80% of the cattle had been destroyed. The destruction of the villages that I already briefly mentioned has been highlighted as a central element of the war since the early post-war period. And over the years, and especially beginning in the 1970s, more and more testimonies about these campaigns began to emerge. For example, in the book Я из огненной деревни by Алис Адамович and several others, provides a number of narratives about the destruction of these villages. And the film Иди и смотри, that some of you may know, or Come and See in English, provides a very graphic portrayal of this violence and is actually based on some of the material from the book. The terror against the population therefore came to exemplify the brutal war against Soviet civilians and was in fact part of the Soviet charge of crimes against humanity during the Nuremberg trials in 1946. The state memorial in Khatyn that I already mentioned earlier, that was opened in 1969, commemorates the more than 619 villages that were destroyed during the German occupation. At least 186 of these were never rebuilt. And I say here at least because the exact number of these settlements and villages that were destroyed is still unclear. And of course, the memorial is symbolic in that way. The list of villages has grown over several years. And in fact, in 2010, the Belarusian government started a new initiative to account for all the war damages, specifically the destruction of these villages. And since then, a web-based database that is publicly accessible that you can research aims to collect information about all the destroyed villages and account for the dead as well as to offer assistance to survivors if there still are any. As of last week, 9,093 settlements are captured by the database, so that includes villages that were destroyed and rebuilt, but also those that were not rebuilt. So Khatyn, located 54 kilometers away from Minsk, is very much at the center of Belarusian war memory. It's the central memorial site. Many official ceremonies on Victory Day, May 9th, or the Day of Liberation, July the 3rd, are conducted at the site. Many high-ranking officials participate, but also regularly at major anniversaries, as, for example, in March 2013, the public goes to the place to commemorate people who died, on one hand, on the in Khatyn itself, which was a village that was destroyed during a punitive operation in March 1943, when in retaliation for a partisan attack on a German troop transport, the 149 residents of the villages were herded into the barn and burned alive. 75 of them were children under the age of 16. Only 5 children and 1 adult survived. And the one surviving adult is actually the local blacksmith, the statue that you see in the center here. The village was set on fire and ceased to exist. So Khatyn very much exemplifies the destruction of these Belarusian villages. And it is comprised of multiple elements that speak to the destruction of Khatyn and other villages. For one, you have chimneys erected, or symbolic chimneys erected at the locations of the homes that were destroyed during the actions, with plaques listing the residents of each individual house. The cemetery of villages, which includes 185 villages, again a symbolic number, that were destroyed in a similar fashion to Khatyn. 108 of these villages were located in Vitebskaya Oblast, so the region that I'm talking about. The Tree of Life Memorial honors the memory of 433 Belarusian villages, and again, that number is changing, that were destroyed but rebuilt after the war. And the three birches that you see here, or actually more the absence of the fourth, symbolizes the death of every fourth Belarusian during the war. The monumental wall of memory indicates the names of concentration camps and sites of mass execution in Belarus, where more than 1.4 million residents perished during the war. Overall, Khatyn is a very quiet place. Except for the rings of bells on each of the symbolic chimneys, the silence is painful. Over the years, the memorial became a place of memory and grief for the thousands whose relatives have no grave. For some Jews, in fact, Khatyn may function as a memorial to the suffering and death of their families and communities. Among the destroyed were many that were inhabited by Jews during the war, and there was no other site to commemorate the killing of Jews. Thus, in a way, we could think about Khatyn as a site of memory like no other in Belarus, the first to prominently feature the civilian losses rather than the victorious or fallen soldiers, and perhaps also broad enough to include all residents of Belarus if they inscribe their and their community into the accepted portrayal of the war as an attack on Belarus and its population as a whole. But I would argue distinction matters. And this is why I would like to return to Bezhenkovichi, a small town in the east of Belarus, to explain why and how the memory of the Holocaust is specific, differs from the destruction of the villages, but also why it still continues to be a very contested matter in Belarus. Bezhenkovichi, at some point by the late 19th century, was what we would call a Jewish shtetl. More than 70% of the population was Jewish. Following the October Revolution in 1917, many Jews left town, so that by the late 1930s, the population was only 16% Jewish. Nonetheless, if you ask residents and if you look at some of the testimonies, local residents continue to describe as about 80% Jewish in 1939, which is surely a sign that Jewish culture continued to play an important role in the local life and was very much present. For instance, local non-Jewish residents spoke Yiddish, and students of Belarusian or Russian nationality enrolled in the Jewish seven-year school. And until today, you can see some traces of this Jewish life, even though they're not marked. So, for example, the Jewish cemetery, as a picture of 2015, was very much an abandoned place in the forest. If you went there 2 years ago, it was often littered with trash. People were picnicking there and just hanging out. Now a group of volunteers is actually cleaning up the space and trying to bring it back into existence as a cemetery, as a place of memory. And there's some tensions with the local population. On the other hand, we have a few buildings that were left, for example, the former synagogue, which, however, after or in the late 1930s, was used as a house of pioneers, so communal cultural center, later as a factory, now it's abandoned. There's no sign that this used to be a synagogue, so if you don't know anybody who could tell you about it, you wouldn't necessarily know. There's also the former Jewish school, which is now used as a dormitory of the local police forces, and you can see the historical marker here. The only thing that it indicates is that it's from the 19th century. So it doesn't tell you anything about the history of this building. And yet it is still there. And so we can still find some traces of a very active and dynamic Jewish presence in the town that existed before World War II. All of that changed, however, in June 1941, when German troops advanced through Belarus and defeated Soviet troops. Relationships between individuals changed, with everyone scrambling to find safety or amass material possessions that could be of use to survive a war. And Yakov Genin, who was then 16 years old, describes his and several other Jewish adolescents' attempts to flee the area, but also how they were treated by locals, what he says, with a particular attitude. When Germans caught up with the group and turned them around toward Bezhenkovichi, these hooligans, as he calls them, took away our little suitcases, our coats. Basically, they robbed us. And he also recalled that both Germans and local residents took to calling their Jewish neighbors Jude, which is the German word for Jew, which clearly delineates a break from the rather friendly pre-war relations where Jews and non-Jews apparently lived side by side quite peacefully. War and occupation regime disrupted this fragile community and inserted violence into local relationships in other ways too. A camp for captured Soviet soldiers was established in the center of town, and residents regularly witnessed horrible abuse as well as executions of Soviet prisoners of war, but also civilians that were accused of sabotage or aiding partisans. The former teacher, of the town, became the was at the helm of the local police. Vladimir Tserkovsky, also a teacher, became the village elder or starost, which essentially was a civilian leadership figure that was assigned by the Germans. And according to witness statements, not only helped to enforce German laws and rules, but he personally humiliated Jews. This and a substantial number of residents who worked for the Germans must have been a deeply humiliating and upsetting experience for the local Jewish community, especially when this engagement concretely targeted them. And that happened quite soon after the occupation began, when many homes that had burned down during the severe fighting in July 1941, and locals lost their homes. Often Germans would kick out Jews out of their homes to find housing for non-Jewish locals, but also for German officers and other personnel. By late July, the local Jews, which were mostly women, children, and elderly, because most younger men had been drafted into the Soviet army or had managed to evacuate, had to move into a limited number of homes, meaning they were placed in what we would call a ghetto. And you can see that there were two locations, one kind of close to the center of town. There used to be a synagogue at one point, but also on the other side of the western Dwina, the river, which is a place called Strelka, which was kind of part of Beshinkovichi, but also separated from it through the river. But in that place, as I have been able to reconstruct, there was only one house designated as the ghetto, where more than 20 Jews apparently had to find shelter. In addition to the ghettoization, Jews were essentially removed from all local networks that they had to find support. They didn't have access to food, unless, and some people report that they did receive help from former neighbors who were compassionate enough to come to them and bring food, for example. Local Jews, however, had to wear yellow patches on their clothes, on the front and back, so that whenever they were, when they left the ghetto, they were essentially recognizable and essentially open to abuse by occupation forces, but also by local policemen, who also used their position of power to break into the homes to abuse, often rape women or steal property. All of the 100 to about 150 Jewish men who had not been drafted into the army and were still local, but also women, had to report for forced labor every morning. Often this work continued in crushing bricks to cover roads, so make it easier for the German troops to move around, felling trees in the parks or forests, or as Yaakov Genin again describes, when there was no real work to do, the Germans also made us dig holes or drag stones from one place to another. So completely useless work in some ways. The men received some food, but it was not enough, obviously, to sustain their families. So that by the end of the fall 1941, the level of starvation in the ghetto was immense, and many people were dying of starvation. But in addition, individual Jews were also shot for no apparent reason. Most of them were men who may or may not have been in touch with partisan movements. There's some contradicting witness statements. So on the other hand, where Jews were outcasts and severely limited in their movement and ability to survive, non-Jewish residents were not restricted in their movement in the same way. Some report that they did prefer to stay home as much as possible, primarily to avoid capture for forced labor in Germany. But on the other hand, they also describe kind of a glimpse of normalcy that they were able to maintain throughout the occupation. And most drastically, these contrasting experiences come into view when one of the residents, Clara S., I don't know her last name because Yad in Unum anonymizes their witness statements, one of the sources I've been working with recently. She was 11 at the time, remembers February 11th of 1942. She was sledding at the riverbanks with a friend when they noticed a large group of people being led across the ice of the river. And I had a picture of a floating bridge that till today exists, because till today there is no actual bridge across the river. So they were watching this large group of Jews, up to 1,000, some people say 800, some people say 1,000, were forced out of their homes in the morning hours and led through the town. And that's really unfortunate. Where essentially they were walking through the whole town, so for everybody to see. So the whole local population essentially witnessed the roundup of the Jews and how they were being led to the execution site. And I had a map where you can actually see the path that the Jewish population had to take. members of Einsatzkommando 9, which was the Einsatzgruppen Kommando that was active in the area, supported by local police, worked together to collect all the Jewish residents. Notably, non-Jewish witnesses admit that locals participated at that day, but none of them is actually willing to identify just who these people were. So there is an acknowledgement, but it's also not concrete. Several people who had been forced into the column were shot on the spot or along the way, some of them because they tried to run away or because they were unable to move fast enough. And this is where the local police actively participated. Locals suspected or knew what was happening, because some report that they stayed away or locked themselves in for good reason. One older Belarusian man, for example, was pushed into the column by a German, but managed to convince one of the local policemen that he actually isn't a Jew and that he should be let go, and he was able to leave. Other locals had been ordered to report in the morning with sleds to the site where the Jews were gathered, and they were then asked to essentially collect the dead bodies that were left behind. So, for example, of the people who had been killed as they were being led to the execution. This is a street that the Jewish group had to walk past. And here you can see it's about 2 kilometers, so it's a fairly long path. If you especially consider the very harsh winter in 1942, and people essentially worked from the ghetto through town across the river into a forestry area, and we will learn more about that in just a second. Some people were trying to hide, but were actually dragged out of their hiding places by locals, including a former teacher of biology who pulled out a woman of a basement, and another local, Stepan Gudian, who's actually known by name, also dragged out a woman from a hiding place and delivered her to the collection point. The Jews were taken to a place in the forest where the day before Soviet prisoners of war had to dig 2 large pits. And upon arrival there, Jews had to undress down to their underwear and were shot in small groups. Small children and the weak or ill and elderly were thrown alive into the pit and killed by a hail of bullets. And we've heard about these shootings already. Residents of Strelka and Beshinkovichi heard the shots all day. Local residents were then brought in to sort the clothing that was left behind by the Jewish shooting victims. And the gravesite was cordoned off for several days afterwards, though some residents shared that the surface of the soil continued to move, supposedly or probably because people were still alive in the grave. So some people must have actually been there and across the cordon. So I assume these were local policemen who spread the information about the moving gravesite. Later in March, the site was covered with carbolic acid when, with the onset of the thaw, the smell of decomposition began to spread, and that's a very common practice in the areas where these mass killings happened. After the execution, many of the clothing that was left behind by the murdered Jews was auctioned off among locals in the schoolyard. Abandoned homes of Jewish families were occupied by locals as well. Many of these homes were destroyed later, especially when Soviet and German troops fought over the area toward the end of the war. And in fall 1943, the Germans doused the surface of the graves with gasoline and set it on fire, presumably attempting to erase the remaining traces of the graves. I assume, and some other scholars who I've discussed this with, assume that this was probably part of the so-called Aktion 1005, an operation during which Soviet prisoners of war, ghetto inmates, or locals were taken to mass execution sites where they then had to unearth mass graves, remove and burn the corpses of Jews, Soviet soldiers, or others who had been killed earlier on these sites. Ashes were then strewn about the surrounding areas or dumped in rivers. So in the end, we don't actually know where the gravesite is. That's the result of this operation. In spring 1944, Vitebsk Oblast was the site of intense fighting, with German troops trying to fend off the Soviet advance and attacking partisan forces in the area. And local residents of Beshinkovichi, like many others, you hear these reports from other areas of especially eastern Belarus were used to uncover domains placed by partisans and others in the sense that they had to walk along the roads before German troops would march or drive on them. And many of, were injured or died when they triggered these explosives. Local police, it appears, and as Lyudmila Mikhailovskaya reports, were very brutal, actually, in participating in the withdrawal with German troops and set everything on fire during the retreat, and essentially helping to create a situation in which many locals had to leave the town and seek shelter in the surrounding forests. By June 26, 1944, Bezhenkovichi was liberated from the German occupation. Up until then, more than 10,000 residents of the district Bezhenkovichi were killed. In the town of Bezhenkovichi alone, about 5,000. German rule thus had decimated the local population, Jewish and non-Jewish alike, with 2,900 Jews as part of the 5,000. But it had also laid bare the frictions and divisions within the Soviet population, including the shooting of the Jews, which was possible only because locals were actually willing to help identify, round up, and potentially even shoot them. The Soviet Extraordinary State Commission for Ascertaining and Investigating Crimes Perpetrated by the German Fascist Invaders and Their Accomplices, short JGK, I think it's an abbreviation that many of us are using and are familiar with, recorded two large grave sites for the murder of Bezhenkovichi's Jews, though at this point only the location of one of them is known among locals, again based on actually witness statements of two men who were watching the shooting. Like many other graves, such as those of soldiers who died in the fighting, or of prisoners of war or civilians, the mass grave remained unmarked for several years. But in the early 1950s, Lazar Mitzengendler, one of the Jews who had returned to Bezhenkovichi from evacuation, took it upon themselves to collect donations from survivors. There were about few people who managed to evade the actual execution, and a few more who had managed to evacuate in 1941, and they collected donations to place a memorial on the gravesite, which was erected in 1958. It's a memorial that roughly resembles an obelisk, and it figures the number of 1,068, presumably to include a group of Jewish professionals who had been spared in February 1942, but were killed later that year, but also Jews from surrounding villages, such as Chashniki, Seno, Ula, who had been caught up in the Bezhenkovichi as well. So there is some contestation about the numbers, and I'll come back to that later. But Mitzengendler essentially is one of the memory activists, the very early memory activists in the Soviet Union, who on one hand organized the establishment of this memorial, but he also, essentially his home became a destination for the Jews who had survived or relatives who had family in Bezhenkovichi and who died and wanted to visit the grave. So there's this one person who was very central in the post-war period. Almost all Jewish survivors who I was able to speak with owned a photo of the memorial's dedication in 1958, and my colleagues and I are currently trying to reconstruct who is actually on this picture, because that would be a very important source, partly because we still want to kind of trace the history of this monument and how was it actually possible to create it. Because as you may know, in the post-war Soviet period, it wasn't necessarily opportune to create memorials specifically for Jews on these mass graves. So establishing this memorial marked the otherwise invisible gravesite, in addition to protecting the area from further defacement. The site of mass murder thus became a concrete and physical site of commemoration and functioned, I think, in a way similar to the lieu de mémoire that Pierre Noir identifies in his analysis of the spatial constitution of memory. In addition, the site acquired symbolic value. As I already said, the number 1,068 is a stand-in for the actual number of the victims on this place, but also in other primarily unidentified places in the region. And in a way, this memorial thus commemorates the community that was annihilated and not only the concrete individuals who are buried in these graves. It turned into a site for the remaining Jews with roots in Bezhenkovichi to come together and figured as something akin to a sacred center as the locus of a Jewish community in Bezhenkovichi after it has ceased to exist as such. On the other hand, in 1956, before this memorial on the Jewish mass grave was established, municipal authorities placed a monument on the site of a mass grave for 142 Soviet soldiers who died during the fighting in June and July 1944, including four who were honored as heroes of the Soviet Union. An obelisk of 1964 commemorates 300 prisoners of war and civilians, and Kurgan Slavli, or the Mound of Glory, on this side, honors Soviet soldiers and partisans, and it was dedicated near the main road of Bezhenkovichi in 1966. A monument to commemorate the members of the local Komsomol was established in 1970 in a park located centrally in the town across the building of the Isbolnitelny Komitet, which is the local executive committee. Local residents and workers and partisan helpers were honored with a statue near the main road close to the town, town limit. You can see that here in 1966. And then the last one in 2007, a grave of victims of fascism, which commemorates the killing of several civilians in the late phase of the war. And all of these monuments are located in the center of town in the site of annual ceremonies, as for example here on Victory Day. The local museum, or Museum of Local History, includes an exhibition on the Soviet society during World War II, but the only mention of civilian losses relates to the destruction of Belarusian villages. According to the exhibition, four villages of the rayon were destroyed, but by now there's actually a higher number available. One of them, the village of Korenovo, is commemorated in Khatyn in the cemetery of villages. So in a way, we can say that commemorating and honoring the military and the non-Jewish residents or the destruction of the villages is a widely accepted practice. And one resident who I was able to interview explained, "I go on my own when there is a ceremony at the common grave of the soldiers, at the Lenin statue, or for the Komsomolce. This is simply my duty, to honor my ancestors." Asked whether local residents visit the gravesite on the other side of the river, the answer typically is negative. And so the mass grave is outside of town, it's across the river, up a hill, and kind of back in this forest. So people say they almost never go there. Several claimed that they never went there because it is too far. One woman evoked a specter of violence associated with the site to explain why she avoided to go there. She said, "I never went to the grave. I was afraid. I was afraid of what these people had gone through." Others stated that they went there by accident when they were collecting berries or picking up bricks from the nearby brick factory. One woman recalled seeing the memorial when she and the family picnicked in the woods nearby. And I asked a former secretary of the Komsomol, who's by now, of course, in her 70s, whether she remembered that this gravesite played any role in the local memorial culture, and then she said no, she's not aware that students or school children ever went to this site. So it really seems to be excluded from local practices of memory, versus visiting the other monuments, she said, serves to keep the memory of her ancestors alive, of those who fought and defended against the genocide and against the Germans. Jewish residents of Bezhenkovichi do not seem to belong to this community of ancestors. And I've created a map of these memorial places and sites here, where you can see that all of the memorials or monuments for Soviet soldiers, partisan aides, and local civilians are located in the town, for the Komsomols as well. But the mass grave and the monument for the killed Jews is in the forest. So it's a literal and figurative separation that I think we can see very clearly. And of course, in a way, this is a result of German politics and practices. The killing did take place outside of the town. But I still think that there's also something to think about whether local population, local society could have dealt with that in a different way. In contrast, actually, the memorial in the forest was vandalized several times. Leonid Galbraith, another survivor, remembers that he stumbled over skulls, bones, and pieces of clothing when he visited the grave to commemorate and honor his siblings and parents who were killed at the site. And over the years, there's very, very few people who ever go to this place. In February 2016, so the anniversary of the killing, there were 13 women and men, mostly from out of town, who gathered at the site. This year, there were even fewer. And these are numbers that I'm grateful to Stanislav Lianenko for. He's a local kind of lay historian who's interested in the history and who's helped me reconstruct a lot of this history. And he tells me about these things at this point. He's also the one who now organizes groups of high school students to clean up the area around the grave twice a year, primarily around the anniversaries. And so, of course, such efforts have the potential to pass on knowledge about the Jewish past of Bezhenkovichi, but given the lack of institutional support, the memorial and the grave site, and alongside them a central element of the local past, the Jewish history, may just as likely remain at the margins of local consciousness. So in this way, Bezhenkovichi and many other towns in Belarus with a similar history reveal the complexity of war and Holocaust memory in Belarus, primarily by pointing to crucial omissions and marginalizations. Whereas the memory of fallen soldiers, partisans, and Belarusian residents occupies a central place in the town, the memory of Jewish residents is literally and figuratively sidelined. Younger residents don't know about the mass killing, and they often don't even know that there was a sizable Jewish population in this town at some point. One could, and some do, of course, argue that it is not necessary to make these distinctions because the murdered Jews were Soviet citizens and should therefore consider to be part of those who are commemorated. I think, however, that the distinction is necessary. In part, Belarusians suffered, that there's no question, as soldiers, partisans, and civilians. And the destruction of villages was one of the most brutal forms of warfare during World War II. But it was not a genocide. Jews had no place to go. They were hunted down in their hometowns, they were chased into forests and swamps, and they were reported by their neighbors. Villagers were not killed because of their ethnicity. The goal was not to eradicate all Belarusians. The difference in goals can be seen, for instance, and then even if it was limited, encouragement by the German occupation authorities to create Belarusian cultural organizations that would maintain some cultural heritage. Belarusians were recruited into police forces, and they occupied local and regional leadership positions. Jews, however, were killed systematically, as was their culture. There are very few synagogues left, and as you can tell in this example, they're not known as such to many people. Most Jewish buildings that did survive are not identified as such. So in a way, Jewish heritage has indeed been eradicated by mass killings, but also by denied memory. But we have witnesses, and this is kind of trying to come back to the very beginning of my talk, that everybody who I quoted here, these are local residents, these are survivors, there are spaces and places that we can explore. All of these are witnesses in some ways. So witnessing the Holocaust in Belarus just perhaps means to witness several layers of destruction. For one, the destruction that laid the whole country to waste, displaced and killed millions, destroyed infrastructure and community to an extent that took decades to repair. Secondly, the swift destruction of multinational communities by stigmatization and ghettoization of local Jewish residents. Third, the mass shootings, the mass killings. Fourth, Aktion 1005, when graves were opened and bodies burned to essentially erase the traces of the murder. Fifth, the marginalization of commemorating the Jewish communities. And last but not least, witnesses to the genocide include the current residents. Unaware of the Jewish past of their hometowns, they may be unwilling, but certainly they are unwitting witnesses to the thorough destruction of Jewish life and culture in Belarus. As of now, unfortunately, what remains are a number of modest memorials erected primarily by local Jewish communities. Many of those were erected in the early 1990s or 1990s. For example, here, the sculpture, The Last Journey, at a mass killing site in the middle of Minsk, of the capital of Belarus. but there's a number of attempts or existing memorials to these Jewish mass graves in a number of towns by now. But they're very often very modest and really an outcome of Jewish community activism and not supported by state authorities. In contrast, the state-sponsored commemoration continuously manages to skirt naming the genocide or its victims. And as a kind of closing example here, the most recently dedicated memorial at the site of the former extermination camp Mali Trostinets, just outside of Minsk, where hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed, the word Jew is nowhere to be seen. And you can see that, which is a great disappointment to many people, because this was really a project where people thought, finally, there's going to be a major site of commemoration. But then in the end, if you read, this is the so-called Road of Memory, where you have these plaques for each oblast, each region in Belarus, listing the number of people who died, but they're all chelovyek, they're all people. And of course, it is an open debate. Do we have to distinguish or do we not? I think we should. But in a way, I think that raises or comes back to the question that came up earlier today, which is it unwitnessable or is it unmentionable? And this is, I think, a great question to think about, and maybe we can all do that together.